Shalom, welcome back to the Citizens of the Kingdom. We are in the second part of the video here for the first hour. And when we left off, we were talking about what exactly is a Jew and the whole Jew versus Gentile. Remember, that's the us versus them, the in-group versus everyone else, the kinship group that is believed to be the ones who hold the covenant versus the entire world. Okay, so with that in mind, let's see just some of the writings. Now realize I'm going to be reading certain writings, and this is only a certain perspective from certain people. Not everyone believed this way, but I want to show you that there were some people that believed this way. I need to establish that there were people who believed this way so we can see that this is what Paul is taking issue with. Paul didn't have issue with every single Jewish person out there. That's a complete misunderstanding from Christianity. Okay? He had issue with certain Jews, certain groups of, especially groups of the Pharisees, who were saying certain things were needed for inclusion into the kinship group. Okay? So we need to see first that there was this animosity. And so what I'm going to start with is we're going to read from the book of Jubilees, chapter 22, verse 1 through 16, or 16 through 17, sorry. He says, and realize this is an extra biblical apocryphal book. This is written sometime probably around 200 to 100 BC, but this is used for historical perspective on what they believed. They write, "Separate yourselves from the Gentiles and do not eat with them and do not perform deeds like theirs and do not become associates of theirs, because their deeds are defiled and all of their ways are contaminated and despicable and abominable. They slaughter their sacrifices to the dead and to the demons they bow down, and they eat in tombs, and all their deeds are worthless and vain." So you can see, I mean, that's some pretty harsh language there. All the, you know, they slaughter sacrifices to the deads and demons, and they eat, their deeds are worthless and vain, i.e. they're shameful. These are shameful words, or words of shaming. Okay, so they're saying, separate yourselves from them. Notice that separating is paralleled with do not eat with them. Do not perform deeds like theirs. Okay, I could agree with that. But do not become associates of theirs. How can the Torah go forth from Jerusalem? And beyond that, how can you even live in a world as a, you know, out in the diaspora when you have to associate with them all the time? You see, this is where this problem is coming into play. Okay, we can also see in the Babylonian Talmud and the Jerusalem Talmud. In the Babylonian Talmud, Haggigah 13a, and also in the Babylonian Sanhedrin 90 or 59a, it says a Gentile who studies Torah is liable to the death penalty. And then in Bava Kamma 4.3, transmitting the words of the Torah to a Gentile is prohibited. That seems to be a little bit problematic if we're talking about the Torah going forth from Jerusalem. Like in Isaiah, in the latter part chapters of Isaiah, where it says that they're supposed to be a light to the nations. How can they be a light to the nations without letting them read the Torah? Now realize we've got to counterbalance this with, there's other statements in there that also talk about the, you know, the Gentile who studies the Torah is as if he's the high priest. So, you know, you got to realize the Talmud is not some sort of a book that completely is you know, just, you know, law after law or completely in agreement. It's a recording of conversations and disagreements and everything like that. So you've got to take it at face value. This isn't what every Jew in the first century believed, or every Jew in the fifth century with the Talmud formation believed. But what I'm showing you is that there are certain groups within those who are considered to be Jewish or Judean, who believed that they should be separate, that they couldn't study the Torah, that they were unclean, that they were shameful, and they had to be completely abhorred, and you had to stay away from them. Okay. And by the way, all of this stuff is in the PowerPoint. You can find the PowerPoint online on rootedintorah.com. Okay. Now, the next one, this is from Tacitus. This is a Greek historian who's writing. And so this is just the perspective from someone who's Greek. He writes, "These rites, whatever their origin, can be defended by their antiquity. The Jews are extremely loyal towards one another and always ready to show compassion. But towards every other people, they feel only hate and enmity. They sit apart at meals, and they sleep apart, and they abstain from intercourse with foreign women. They instituted circumcision of the genitalia so that they could..." Listen to this. "They instituted circumcision of the genitalia so they could recognize their difference. Those who are converted to their ways follow the same practice. And the earliest lessons they receive is to despise the gods, to disown their country, and to regard their parents, children, and brothers of little account." Okay, so, you know, obviously this is a little bit biased because this is written by someone who's Greek, who hates Jewish people. But, you know, you can see the things that they're pulling out. They feel only hate and enmity towards other people. They sit apart. They sleep apart. They abstain from intercourse with foreign women, and he calls out the circumcision as being one of these things that define who they are. You can tell who they are, and this is important. I'm going to be hammering this point over and over again. It's a marker. It's a badge of who they are. It no longer had become a marker of their covenant loyalty to Yahweh. It became a badge of ethnic identity. Okay? Badge of ethnic identity. That's what it was in the first century. Let's now go to the Tosefta. The Tosefta is written a little bit after the Mishnah, compiled, right, after the Mishnah. And this is what we read in the Tosefta. It's in Avodah Zarah 4.6. And again, I'm using this as a frame of historical reference. Rabbi Shimon ben Eliezer says, "Israelites in the diaspora are worshipers of idolatry. How? The Gentile makes a wedding feast for his son and goes and invites all the Jews who dwell in his city. Even though they, being the Jews, eat and drink from their own stuff and their own steward stands and serves them, nevertheless, they are worshippers of idolatry. As it is written, 'You must not make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, for they lust after their gods and sacrifice to their gods and invite you, and you will eat of their sacrifices.'" So just even though these Jews, they were going to this wedding feast of a Gentile, they brought their own food, they brought their own drink, and they brought their own servant to serve them. This rabbi, Simon ben Eliezer, says that they are idolaters because they're just associating with the Gentiles there. You see the problem that we're facing here? Now, these are just little isolated statements, but realize that the historical evidence shows that there was actually a great deal of interaction between diaspora Jews and their Gentile neighbors. Many of the pagans were actually even attracted to Judaism and became converts. In fact, in around the hundreds of the Common Era, a lot of the upper-class Roman nobility, especially the women, it became fashionable for them to practice Judaism. And if you actually look at a map of all the places where Paul goes and visits and all the places where these early ecclesia, or what we commonly call churches, but you know, realize these believers in Yeshua, they're spreading out into the empire. If you put that on top of a map of where there was already a Jewish presence, it's identical. It's absolutely identical. All these same places that they're going, there were already Jewish people there. They're already living in diaspora. And realize that these statements that I'm reading, most of them are written by people who were from Jerusalem or from Babylon, or even necessarily some of them were from Alexandria. And so these were these areas where there was a large enough concentration of Jews that they could isolate themselves. And so they became very ethnocentric. And the reality is that most diaspora Jews, when they were living out in Rome, in Galatia, and Colossae, all these different places, they had to interact with the Gentiles. So what we're seeing is basically propaganda by certain religious factions. Now realize that other religious factions, also from these same areas, they were saying that it's good for this, right? This is where you've got to understand also what's called the House of Hillel and the House of Shammai. Okay, the House of Hillel, they were a group of Pharisees who were very liberal in their interpretation. In fact, some people have said that Yeshua himself was a Hillel Pharisee. I don't agree with that, but I do say I do agree that he agreed a lot with Hillel, but there was times that he agreed with Shammai as well. He wasn't a blind follower of Hillel by any means. But just because Hillel said it before him doesn't mean that it's not true and that Yeshua can't repeat something that is a valid statement, right? So Yeshua agreed a lot more with Hillel. Shammai, on the other hand, he was very conservative and he was very hateful towards the Gentiles, okay? He released what was called the 18 Edicts of Shammai, and they were 18 edicts against interaction with the Gentiles. Okay, so a lot of this anti, you know, don't eat with the Gentiles, don't associate with them, they're idolaters, you'll become an idolater. A lot of this came from what is called the House of Shammai. Okay, and realize that, you know, these two houses didn't go out and exist in Judaism separately for thousands of years. After the destruction of the temple, they kind of came together, and a lot of the Hillel rulings kind of took charge, but there's a lot of Shammai influence in there as well, especially this anti-Gentile attitude that we see going on as well. Now, if we actually go and we look at actual historical archaeological evidence, it shows that the Jews living in the land of Judea in the first and second century wore clothing that was indistinguishable from non-Jews. You couldn't just look at someone and realize that they were Jewish. You know, you see these movies with these, you know, these pompous Pharisees, and you start to get this image in your mind that all Jews walked around like this with tefillin on their head and tzitzit and a prayer shawl or whatever. That's not the case. And that's not me saying that. That is Mr. Shay Cohen, who's Jewish, who has actually gone and done the research in the first century. Most Jews, he says, the wearing of tzitzit and tefillin were known of, but it was noted by the rabbis that the Jews living in the diaspora were outside of rabbinic control and did not wear tzitzit nor tefillin. Realize, in the first century, you only had about 1 to 2 million Jews living in the land. Most of them, the other 5 to 6 million of them, lived out in diaspora. So most Jews in the first century did not wear tzitzit or tefillin. I know that probably comes as a shock to you, but that's not me. That's archaeological, historical evidence that tells that. You can see that. That's on page 34 here. I'll read it directly for you so that you know this isn't my research. This is from Shay Cohen, How They Behaved, okay? Because I know I'm going to get someone who's going to be really upset with me saying this, okay? I'll just start a little bit up above it. It says, thus, in rabbinic piety, tzitzit could serve as a marker to distinguish a Jew from a Gentile and indeed to hamper intimate relations between Jewish men and Gentile women. The rabbinic imagination, tefillin, could serve the same function. The letter of Aristides mentions both tefillin and tzitzit. Philo and Josephus also mention tefillin. Greek-speaking Jews in the diaspora thus knew of tzitzit and tefillin, but unlike the rabbis, they never referred to them as markers of Jewish identity. And then he goes on, he keeps on going on, and discussing all of that. there. So that's the reality of the first century. Also, contrary to what a lot of people in Judaism would tell you today, the common language of Jews in the first century in the Roman Empire, guess what it was? It was Greek. Those in the diaspora. In the land of Judea, it would have been Aramaic, and as you get closer and closer to Jerusalem, Hebrew more and more, right? But out in the diaspora, most diaspora Jews spoke Greek. Philo wrote in Greek. Josephus wrote in Greek. We also know that many of the diaspora Jews went by Gentile names. It did not. They would have a Gentile name and a Hebrew name. But whenever they would, whenever we find, evidence like, letters or, anything that they had, they would use their Greek name and not their Hebrew name. Okay. Again, maybe a little bit of a shock to you, but realize when they're, we're talking outside of the land. We're not talking about in Jerusalem. We're not talking about even in Galilee. In Galilee, they would have spoken Aramaic. There's intense evidence that in Galilee they spoke Aramaic. And in Jerusalem, you have now realize too that most of these people, they didn't speak just one language, right? This I'm talking about their primary language that they used every day. Most of it was Aramaic and Hebrew in Jerusalem. Out in Samaria, you've got Aramaic, and then out in diaspora, a lot of them didn't even know Hebrew, or they knew it so little that, for them, it was difficult to even read the scripture or listen to someone read the scriptures. Realize they didn't have Bibles. They had to go to the synagogue and have someone read it out loud to them because there was very few scrolls. But that's why the Septuagint became such a popular thing in the first century. And that's why, basically they created it for this library, but then all these Jews are like, hey, it's in a language that we can understand because this is the language that we use. And so that they started making many, many copies of the Septuagint because that was the language that everyone spoke. Now, you go to Jewish people today and they actually are very, that's one of their problems with so-called New Testament, with the apostolic writings, is they say, well, it quotes from the Septuagint more than it does the Hebrew Bible. Well, first off, the majority of the quotes from the Tanakh that are in the apostolic writings in the New Testament, they're identical in both the Greek and the Hebrew. So you can't say that it's a copy. It's something like 70 or 80% of them are exactly identical in both the Hebrew Bible and in the Septuagint. And outside of that, there's times where the translation matches up with the Hebrew. There's times it matches up with the Septuagint. And realize these are such minor little nitpicky little things that it's not even a deal. But the thing was, it was that because once the believers started referring to themselves as the church and Christians, and once they started that animosity towards the Jewish people see, oh, wait a minute, these people, they're reading the Septuagint, they're swearing by the Septuagint, we don't want to be like them. Let's say no Septuagint. Greek is a horrible language. Let's all only read it in Hebrew, right? So realize that Greek versus Hebrew translation of the Old Testament, of the Tanakh, is something that was invented well after the time of Yeshua and well after the time of Paul. In the time of Paul, they had no problems with using the Septuagint, okay? In addition to this, most Jews were very poor. Jews in Rome were widely reputed to be beggars. And many times, in fact, there is a story that Shay Cohen talks about where basically these two Roman soldiers, they posed as Jews and they went in into the temple and went all the way to where they shouldn't have been, past the court of the Gentiles. And no one stopped them. No one recognized them as not being Jewish, just in their regular everyday clothing. Okay, so realize that this whole idea that the Jews were somehow distinguishable by their clothing really does not hold up to the light of evidence. Okay, so I'm going to throw up this graphic here on the screen. This is the best way to understand what it meant to be Jewish in the first century. Okay, we've got the covenant and being connected to God, to Yahweh, right? We've also got the culture, right? So there's this cultural aspect of being Jewish, and there's also the connection to the land itself. And all three of those things, when you've got Yahweh, the land, and culture all coming together, that's what makes someone Jewish. But again, there was no simple single definition, okay? Someone could be considered Jewish by one group, but not considered Jewish by another group. Let's say that someone converted to Judaism into the group, into the Sadducees. Are the Pharisees going to recognize them as Jewish? Probably not. What about, someone who's an Essene? Do the Essenes recognize Pharisaic conversion? Probably not. It's just like today, okay? Don't go out and do this, but I've talked to people who have converted to Judaism under like a conservative rabbi or a reformed rabbi, and guess what? Now they try to go to Israel and say they're Jewish. Guess what an Orthodox rabbi is going to say? No, you're not. All right? Just like you can't convert to Karaite Judaism and have an Orthodox rabbi accept you as being Jewish. What is this telling us? That being Jewish is a matter of opinion, if you will. It's a matter of viewpoint. Are you considered, right? And so when these early believers, when Paul is converting people who were considered Gentiles, a lot of them were actually God-fearers, and we'll talk about what that means later on, that they were already interested. It wasn't like they were, one day slaughtering their son to Baal, and then the next day they're worshiping Yahweh. But you've got to realize that when Paul converts them and they believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they may be accepted by the other believers in Yeshua, but are they accepted by the other Jews in the community as being part of that community, right? Just like if you go and you're baptized at one Christian church, is another Christian church, are they going to consider you, they want you to be baptized into their church in order for them to consider you. You see how all this stuff works? It's very viewpoint oriented. Being Jewish wasn't like, it was a clearly defined thing, and it wasn't like everyone agreed on it. And so what we're seeing in the letters of Paul is him echoing these disagreements. And by the way, he wasn't the only one. We'll talk about this later on, but in this book, Paul Within Judaism, Mark Nanos discusses the Josephus's writings about these advisors to King Azates of another country, and there was a discussion between non-Yeshua-believing rabbis over how to become Jewish, whether it was through circumcision or not. So realize that Paul is well within the realm of first century disagreements within Judaism over these people who are converting, whether they're Jewish or non-Jewish. This is nothing new. Okay, that shouldn't be surprising. So we've got the viewpoint of the Jewish community, right? Do they accept you as being Jewish? You got the viewpoint of the Greco-Roman community. Once they see that you started following Torah, that you're hanging out with Jews all day, you're keeping the Shabbat, you're not eating kosher, you're eating kosher, you're not going to their pagan celebrations, even if the Jewish community doesn't consider you Jewish, the Greco-Roman community is going to consider you Jewish. Does that make sense? So think about this. In 49 AD, Emperor Claudius is said to have kicked all of the Jews out of Rome. Now, we know that there were believers in Yeshua in Rome. Okay, so if he kicks all the Jews out of Rome, who's defining who's Jewish? The Roman authorities who are driving them out. So whomever they consider to be Jewish is kicked out, which means that there were probably, we can't prove this because we just don't have any, evidence one way or the other, but more than likely, a lot of the early converts to Yeshua-centered Judaism, Judaism with the belief in Yeshua, these converts to the belief in Yeshua and the belief of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because of how they're living, they're going to be considered Jewish and they're going to be kicked out of Rome just like all the other Jews who don't believe or who do believe, right? You see what I'm getting at? Now, not only this, we've got the Jewish community, local community. Well, does the Jerusalem leadership, do they accept that community's ruling whether that person is Jewish or not? Right? Because Paul, he had fully accepted this group of people, of believers, these converts. But then you've got Peter and these others from where? From Jerusalem. And they come and they separate themselves out and they're sitting at a different table. And so Paul has to confront this because in Paul had accepted them as being part of his kinship group, but they had rejected that. Okay? So is that making sense to you? I'm hoping that, you know, this is really a lot of probably new stuff. And for me, this took a little while to wrap my mind around, just kind of thinking about all the different angles of what it meant to be Jewish, what it meant to be Judean, as we would better say in the first century. And without understanding this, we're going to really misunderstand Paul and come to think that maybe he converted and he wasn't Jewish, or maybe Yeshua himself wasn't Jewish because it says the Jews came to him. You got to realize terms, defining terms. This is one of the key problems I've noticed. Whenever I observe two people getting into an argument, a lot of the time it's because they haven't agreed on a definition of terms, right? Keeping the Torah to an Orthodox Jew means keeping the oral Torah and the written Torah. Keeping the Torah to a Messianic means keeping the Torah as it's found in the written word. But they both are using the same term, and they may, you know, one, you know, a Messianic believer may come up to them and say, oh yeah, I keep the Torah, and they'll be like, well, why did you turn on that light switch on Shabbat? You know, why aren't you wearing a kippah? If you're not wearing a kippah, you're not keeping the Torah, right? We've got to learn to, before we really get into a disagreement with someone, we've got to understand how they define terms, and they need to understand how we define terms. Otherwise, we're going to be sitting there yelling at each other, but not really communicating because we are speaking, even though it seems like we're speaking English together, we're not speaking the same language because we're defining terms in different manners. Okay? And sometimes it's better for us, maybe we don't call ourselves Torah keeping anymore. Maybe we call ourselves Torah pursuant, or, you know, I'm sure you've seen stuff like this, Torah observant. It differentiates us from their mindset of what that means. Okay, so sometimes it's better to maybe change your terminology a little bit so that your message can get across. You're not compromising your values, you're just adjusting your language so that the other person you're speaking to can understand what you're saying, which is why I sometimes use Lord, I sometimes use New Testament, Old Testament, Christian, you know, church. I sometimes use those because if I'm speaking to someone who doesn't understand the way that I, you know, I use words, they're going to completely not understand me, and then my message won't get across. Amen. All right, so I hope you're enjoying this, and we'll be back in the next part. We're going to start talking about circumcision. All right, so until next part, we'll see you. Shalom.